It is my privilege to welcome our teacher today. Dr. Paula Williams is an internationally known speaker who speaks often on the topics of gender equity and LGBTQ advocacy. She's also the pastor of preaching and worship at Left Hand Church in Longmont, Colorado, is a resident of Lyons. She's a good friend of DCC, has taught here a number of times already this calendar year, and we're really excited to have her do so again this morning. So would you please welcome Paula to the platform?
So since I live in Lyons, I'm able to go every fall to Rocky Mountain National Park during the rut, during the time that the elk are in their mating season. And it's always absolutely fascinating because you go into any of the moraines and there will be one large alpha male with two things on his mind. On one hand, he's trying to make sure he does not lose any females from his circle of influence. And on the other hand, he's got to take on every young bull male who thinks he's got what it takes to take down the alpha. Now, the young bull males all have just one thing on their mind. They want to place their seed in as many places as possible to create as many progeny as possible because, hey, they're not the ones who have to raise them. But after all of these young males see one or two of their peers get their antlers bashed in by the alpha, you see them all begin to retreat, and you can tell they're thinking, you know, maybe I'll just wait till next year to try to challenge the alpha. And the whole time, the females are just looking up occasionally saying, I don't care who wins, I just need a calf by spring. But I no longer watch the elk. I now watch the humans watching the elk. Now, the guys are always choosing sides, either the alpha male or one of the challengers, and I mean, they're getting into it like it's a Broncos game. And their wives are always standing behind them, chuckling. And you know what the wives are thinking. The wives are thinking, have we really evolved all that far as a species? We live in a patriarchal world. That means it's a world where most of our systems and structures were created when men had complete and utter power over women. And so the structures that were created were structures with which men are often quite comfortable. Therefore, mostly, most of our systems in our culture have a top-down, alpha, vertically-based, hierarchical system. And a lot of men are comfortable working in that system. Now, when men get into a room, generally the first thing they do is identify who the alpha is in the room. And then once they've identified that alpha, they will rank themselves according to the alpha. And then once that's been done, men will work together collaboratively to advance the causes of the alpha. Or to put it in sports analogy, they will get in a huddle, slap each other in the butt, and then advance the quarterback and the ball down the field. Men are comfortable in these vertically, hierarchically based, alpha-based systems. And the truth is, a minority of women are also comfortable working in alpha-based systems. The problem for women is getting access to those systems. 4.8% of Fortune 500 CEOs are female. 6% of Silicon Valley CEOs are female, 2% of movie directors, 11% of writers, 19% of producers, 47% of first-year law associates are female, but only 15% make partner. Now, 2 weeks ago, I was speaking at the Forbes magazine headquarters in New York City to 130 female founder CEOs of some very large corporations. After talking, so many of them came up to me and they said, you know, the reason I started my company was not just because I had a good idea, it's because I kept hitting a glass ceiling working in male-operated systems, in those patriarchal, top-down, hierarchical, vertically-based systems. The truth is, the majority of women are not comfortable in those systems, nor are a lot of men, particularly men who are introverts. But there's another problem with these vertically based, hierarchically based, alpha based systems. They can lend themselves to the abuse of power. And so when you look at the kind of systems developed by patriarchy, and you look at the fact that Jesus came into a world filled with patriarchy, you begin to understand why Jesus spoke so much about power. And he begins in his Sermon on the Mount in the Beatitudes. From the very beginning, he talks about what is necessary for us to be capable leaders who are not too focused on power. So he begins with, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for they will inherit the kingdom of heaven." But that word that's translated poor in spirit, that's actually not a common translation of that word. The most common translation of that word is confused. So if you put that in there, he's saying, "Blessed are the confused, for they will inherit the kingdom of heaven," which means, I'm pretty darn blessed. I mean, so many of us look at life and we recognize we'll probably never have a lot of the right answers, but maybe sometime, certainly as we get older and wiser, we might have the right questions. That word also could be translated inquisitive. Blessed are the inquisitive, for they will inherit the kingdom of heaven. Notice those are not people who are sure about much of anything. These are not people who are confident of their position. These are people who are confident of their need to discern. Then he says, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted." But that word mourn means those who mourn the specific nature of their own sins. So he's saying, blessed are the self-aware, because we come to the point we realize that we're not really ever going to get it right. You know, in the first 10 years of your marriage, you're convinced that the marriage is perfect. For the next 10 years, you're convinced the marriage is a mess and it's your spouse's fault. Now, once you've been married about 20 years, you begin to recognize that maybe the problem is you. And then after about 40 years, you realize, oh my goodness, the entire problem was me. These are the people he's talking about. People who have a sense of self-awareness and know their own difficulties, their own problems, and own them. Blessed are those who mourn the specific nature of their own weaknesses, for they will be comforted. He says, blessed are the meek. Who are the meek? Unfortunately, in our lexicon, we tend to think of meek as being weak. Uh-uh. Not what the word meek means. Meekness is people who are able to put together the paradoxical strengths of great confidence and great humility. Now, rarely do you see those things come together in one person. The Catholic theologian Henry Nouwen said the greatest leaders of all time were all meek people. Mother Teresa, Dorothy Day, Gandhi, Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, all of them equal parts great confidence and great humility. It's the meek who changed the world. Then he says, blessed are the peacemakers. Now note, he does not say, blessed are the peacekeepers. Peacekeepers are a dime a dozen. Peacekeepers are people who just don't want to change the status quo, don't want to change the current power structures, don't want to see anything operate differently, which usually means they're pretty comfortable in the current system. Peacekeepers we don't need. We need peacemakers. Peacemakers look at the pseudo-peace, the pretend peace that's out there, and recognize all those who are oppressed, all those who are not holding power, all of those who are powerless, and they set about to change that structure. And to go from pseudo-peace, you must leave next to chaos. And chaos will always lead to emptiness before you find true peace. It is hard to be a peacemaker. It's hard to work toward true peace, because you always have to go from pretend peace to chaos to emptiness to peace. Anybody who's been in marriage therapy knows exactly what I'm talking about. Blessed are the peacemakers. Now, all of these people he's talking about who are blessed are people who are willing to give up their power. And you must be willing to give up your power for us to progress as a species. So 2 weeks ago, my son and I had the great privilege of being invited to the TED Summit in Edinburgh, Scotland. They invited about 100 speakers from TED events all over the world over the last 3 years, and we were two of the people who were invited. I've done 2 TED Talks, and we were asked to speak at the TED Summit to the about 900 people who were there. I did 1 talk to the speakers, and then the 2 of us, my son and I, did what they called a discovery session on the subject, "Is Life Really Easier for Men?" And fascinatingly, the people at TED decided who would be attending this particular workshop. So people weren't self-selecting to come to this. They were being chosen to come to this by the people at TED. So we had about half male, half female each time we presented it. We put them half male, half female at each of the tables, and then we asked four questions. The first question we asked was to the women. We said, talk about your own experience of gender inequity, and then talk about the misogyny you've experienced in your workplace, and if you're comfortable doing so, you can even talk about the sexual experience you've had in the workplace. And men, you can't talk at all. We just want you to listen. And both times we presented it, the men listened quite wonderfully. And the men told stories that were so unbelievable. And yet, if you experience it, you know, are very believable. So the next question we asked, we said to the men, now you can talk, but all you can do is ask questions. You can ask the women to clarify what they talked about before. That's it. And now both times my son and I had to go from table to table because the men didn't want to do that. They didn't want to just ask questions. They wanted to talk. And they wanted to tell the women that they were wrong. They wanted to tell them that, in fact, no, life is not easier for men. And, in fact, everything you're saying about misogyny isn't so. There were several men in the room who were doing that, and we had to go to those tables and keep saying, no, you're allowed to ask questions. That's it. Only questions. Now, after that, we had a third time of questions. We said to the men, now you can speak, but you have to speak only about the power you are willing to give up to bring about gender equity in your environment. And so all the men spoke with great energy about the power they were willing to share, about bringing women up to the same level that they were working from, table after table, which then brought us to the final question. Now, women and men, you cannot speak again. Women, tell us the power you would like to see men give up. And now the women talked about the power they wanted to see men give up, and the men began to realize that they had not talked at all about giving up any power. They had talked about elevating women to their position, but nobody was talking about giving up their power. There was one powerful CEO who left the room when we got to that point. But now here's the thing. The vast majority of men came up to Jonathan and me afterwards, and a lot of them were in tears. They said, we had no idea it was that bad. And I'm telling you, folks, these are people you know by name. And they were in tears saying, I don't want it to be this way. The majority of men don't want to be a part of a patriarchal system that lords it over others. They just don't know what they don't know. So how can they actually give up power? Oh, following the example of Jesus might be a good idea. He continues in the 7th chapter of the book of Matthew in the Sermon on the Mount and talks about specific ways in which we can give up our power, ways that are good for the species. Do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Now, why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? I mean, how can you say to your brother, well, let me take that speck out of your eye, when all the time there is a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye. Then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. There are three religions that are desert religions: Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. They are the three most powerful religions on the face of the earth. All of them developed in the desert, and therefore all developed as religions of scarcity. There's a scarcity of resources in the desert. Not enough food to go around, not enough water to go around. So the attitude in the desert is, we've got to take care of ours. We've got to take care of our tribe. Everyone else is an enemy that only one group can win. Only one group can have enough resources. And so all three of those religions became religions of scarcity, determining some are in and some are out. Now, fascinatingly, all three of those religions also developed a generous form that no longer is about scarcity. In Christianity, it's those who paid serious attention to the teachings of Jesus. But in all three of those religions, in their fundamentalist forms, they are still religions of scarcity. So a few years ago, the Barna Research Group asked Americans what difference Americans see in evangelical Christians. Americans said they see two things different about evangelical Christians. Number one, they go to church, observant lot, we Americans. And number two, they're more judgmental. Of course, you knew that was the answer. Being judgmental is always a power play. It always comes from a mentality of scarcity. My religion is better than yours. My God is better than yours. My moral code is better than yours. I am, in fact, superior to you. When you see judgmental people, there are always three personality traits that are sadly lacking from their lives: grace, mercy, and generosity. To be able to practice grace, mercy, and generosity, you have to have a strong ego structure. A strong ego structure, the easiest way to get that is to have good parents. Parents who give their children the three key building blocks to a strong ego structure: a sense of self-worth, a sense of the safety of their existence, and role models who will delay gratification. But a lot of us don't get that from our parents, but there's a lot of grace in the world. And so we get it from a grandmother or a grandfather or an aunt or an uncle or a teacher or a professor. But somewhere along the line, we get the idea that, thank God, we are enough as we are. And when we have a strong sense of ego, we don't have much ego need. And if we don't have much ego need, it is very easy for us to practice grace and mercy and generosity toward others. But there are a lot of people in the world who have great ego need and very little ego strength. And to those people, there's not an abundance of anything. And if their religion has told them that there is no abundance of love from God, and you add that to their own experience where they've not had financial abundance, they've not had employment abundance, when they're on the wrong side of the tracks where they've grown up and all their people have grown up, of course those people will become judgmental because they just don't have the ego strength. They recognize, if I lose some power, I don't think I will survive. But if you understand that God is a God of abundance, and we live in a universe of abundance, well, now you can give up power because you know you're going to have enough power remaining to be just as strong as you need to be. Jesus is saying, don't judge others. It's a power play. And then he explains the reason we shouldn't be judging others. He begins to explain why the desert religions are getting it wrong and Jesus' teaching is going to get it right. Verse 7, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. He who seeks finds, and to him who knocks, the door will be opened. Now which of you, if his son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will give him a snake? If you then, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, well, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets. 3 weeks ago, I had all five of my granddaughters with me. They're all between 8 and 11 years of age, and they get up extremely early in the morning. And four of the five want to eat right away. The fifth just wants to cuddle for about an hour, which I love. But the four want to eat now. And so every morning, I fix breakfast for them, whatever it was they wanted, because that's what grandparents do. So we might have pancakes and waffles and eggs and bacon and cereal and toast, and I put it all on the plates for them, and they sit down at the table, and they look at me, and they say, Grandpaula, can we eat breakfast? We are so hungry. Please, can we eat breakfast? And I say to them, okay. I mean, it's right there. You've got utensils and food and plates, so yeah, you can eat breakfast. And then they say to me, oh, but please, Grandpaula, please, can we please have breakfast? We're so hungry. Please, can we have breakfast? And I'm like, thought I kind of told you already, but yeah, you can go ahead and eat. See, the food is there. I made it for you. There's actually more in the kitchen. You know, you can, oh, please, Grandpaula, please, can we? That would be ridiculous. They start eating because they know the food is there in abundance. That's what he's saying here. Where did we get this idea that we have to beg God for everything? Oh, God, please, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please. God is saying, hey, it's all yours. I love you just the way you are. You don't have to be a particular way. I can't not love you. Just accept it. Eat the food. It's there in abundance. And then he says, the golden rule. Now, when I was here a couple of times ago, we talked about Hillel, the great Jewish teacher, who in 100 years before Jesus was asked to summarize the Torah. And he said, don't do to anybody else what you wouldn't want people to do to you. That's Torah. Everything else is just explanation. But notice Jesus does not say here, do to others what you expect them to do in return to you. No, he's telling you to initiate regardless of the response you're going to get. Reciprocity is not a part of this. Treat others the way you would like to be treated. Some of them will treat you that way back. A lot of them will not, because they don't have the ego structure that enables them to be able to do that. It's okay, because there's plenty of abundance in the world anyway. And you will, in fact, encounter plenty of people who do treat you the way that you're going to treat them. Be good, because it's the right thing to do. Well, then Jesus goes on, and he says something that I don't think I ever quite understood when I was a kid because of the kind of religious world in which I was raised. He says, enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction. Many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. Now, when I was a child, basically I was taught that this meant, yet not very many people here are going to get into heaven. Probably you're not one of them. In fact, the only people likely to get into heaven are usually the powerful people in your church, mostly men, who are going to tell you all the time that you're doing things wrong, and they're going to give you indication that they believe they're doing things right. They're the ones who might find the narrow way. You're not going to find the narrow way. And so in the extreme fundamentalist world in which I was raised, it was like, well, yeah, you know, you can't go to movies, you can't play cards, you can't smoke, you can't drink, you can't go to a dance, you can't do anything and find the narrow way. None of these things, by the way, mentioned by Jesus. The only people who are going to find the narrow way are the powerful. Interestingly, most of them men. The narrow way has nothing to do with following rules and regulations and earning your way into heaven. The narrow way is recognizing abundance. In the midst of the desert, it was recognizing that God's love is abundant and universal, and it's for all of us. That's the narrow way the world doesn't get. There's enough to go around. There's enough of God's love to go around. There are enough resources in this universe to go around. We don't have to grab for power. Well, he goes on and talks about a particular kind of problem that comes when you're dealing with patriarchal systems, top-down, vertically-based, alpha-based systems of leadership that are male-dominated. He says, watch out for false prophets. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ferocious wolves. By their fruit you'll recognize them. Do people pick grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Likewise, every good tree bears good fruit. But a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, and a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus, by their fruit, you will recognize them. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? And in your name drive out demons and perform miracles? Then I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. So throughout my career, I've worked a lot with megachurch senior pastors. Megachurches are defined in the United States as churches that average over 2,000 in attendance on a weekend. Three different times, I actually preached in one of the 10 largest churches of the United States. I've preached in three of the 10 largest churches in the U.S., which means preaching to like 20,000 people on a weekend. And my doctorate is in pastoral counseling, but with a specialty in counseling pastors. So I've counseled a lot of pastors from very large churches, and a sad thing happens. All of these guys begin in ministry as servants of God who want to get it right. But because these are consistently evangelical churches, and evangelical churches that have only male leadership at the elder level, which means they're dealing with people who primarily are quite comfortable with patriarchal systems with an alpha lead at the top who is rarely, if ever, challenged, a lot of these leaders become very, very narcissistic men. And the more narcissistic they become, the less they're challenged by those within their systems, and you see so many of them fall. They fall because that top-down alpha system did not serve them well from the beginning. They needed a more flat leadership structure. I'm one of three pastors at Left Hand Church. Left Hand Church is a church you helped start in Longmont, Colorado. In fact, John Gettings is the chair of our board. He's actually at my house right now while I'm talking to you because we're having our staff retreat today. But we have three pastors who are co-equal. I'm pastor of preaching and worship. We have someone who's pastor of reconciling ministries, someone who's pastor of executive ministries, and all three of us are equal and responsible to our board, to our leadership council that John shares. Now, it was interesting, when I was speaking at Forbes a couple of weeks ago and I got to the Q&A after my keynote, they had more questions about that than anything else because they recognize that these top-down, alpha-based leadership structures don't serve their companies either, even though they are led by females. And they wanted to talk about flat leadership structures. It's just easier in those flat structures not to have systems that go wrong. One of the things I love here is your eldership. I have watched your eldership for 4 years. By having both men and women and people of great wisdom, people who have an abundance mentality, there is an oversight over your staff that is marvelous in this place. You can trust those kinds of things are not going to happen here. So then Jesus goes ahead and concludes this great, amazing Sermon on the Mount with interesting words. Let's pick it back up. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, yet it did not fall because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority, and not as their teachers of the law. Jesus is talking to people from Palestine. And in Palestine, there was a dry season and there was a rainy season. And if you built a house on sand and a house on rock and it was the dry season, both houses would appear to be absolutely fine. But once the rainy season came, that house built on the sand was going to crumble. Well, folks, we're in the rainy season. We're in a time of polarization in our nation like we've not seen since we began. We've had it a lot over the centuries, but nothing like we have now, nothing like the animosity we see now, nothing like the polarization we see now. This is the rainy season, and if we bring a faith of scarcity into the world, we're not helping anyone. We've got to see the generosity that is there from God. We've got to see the abundance that is there that can bring peace to everyone. So I came home through London, and I came home the same day that Boris Johnson was installed as the new Prime Minister of England. A lot of people there seemed to be very concerned about a hard Brexit, a hard exit from the European Union. And one of the things that a hard Brexit would bring would be a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, which is something that's not happened for 20 years. It would be devastating to Northern Ireland and not good for anyone, really. And it got me to thinking about the story of Northern Ireland. A lot of you are too young to remember that story. But Northern Ireland has a majority that's Protestant, and that majority wants to be a part of the British Commonwealth. But there's a minority, a slight minority in Northern Ireland that's Catholic and has always wanted to be united with the Republic of Ireland. And for decades and decades, they were at war with one another in and around Belfast. There was a name for it that I think was perfect, the Troubles. people killing one another, neighbor killing neighbor, Catholic killing Protestant, Protestant killing Catholic, because they could not agree. In 1995, George Mitchell, the senator from Maine who'd retired, was asked to be a special envoy to Belfast to try to bring about peace that had been elusive to all those who had tried for decades. Every Monday morning, he flew out of JFK, leaving his young wife and young child at home. And he went to Belfast, and for 3 years, he worked with them to bring about peace. And finally, they reached peace. On Good Friday, 1998, it became known as the Good Friday Agreement, but it had to be ratified. And it was one of the most complex peace agreements in the history of mankind because it was actually three agreements. There had to be one agreement between Northern Ireland and Great Britain, one agreement between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, and one agreement between the Republic of Ireland and Great Britain. And it was so successful that in the two places they had to have a public referendum, Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, there was over 80% of the population that voted in favor of this peace accord. It ended decades of violence. The last summer, it was my privilege to speak at the church that George Mitchell and his wife attend in Manhattan. I did not meet him that day, but I was talking to his pastor afterwards. He was quite close to Mitchell, and I said, "So, is he as good as he appears to be?" He said, "Oh my, he and his wife chairs our board, said he is amazing. I mean, think about it. Here's one man who convinced three sovereign nations that they had never in their lives been more powerful than when they gave up their power. We will not change this world until those of us who have the power are willing to give up our power for others. How do we do it? Oh, I think we can follow Jesus, and it'll be pretty clear. Will you pray with me? God, thank you. Oh, thank you for coming to earth to live among us and to show us that there is an abundance of your love. There's an abundance of your grace. There's an abundance of mercy. There's an abundance of generosity, that this is a universe of abundance. There's enough to go around. And help us to realize your love for us is so great that we can trust that abundance and surrender our power so others can live. This we pray in the name of Christ. Amen.